Today, the LA Times issued an apology for a story it published last week, alleging that rap impresario Sean Diddy Combs was in on a 1994 ambush and murder of the rapper Tupac Shakur. The apology came after the website The Smoking Gun asserted that FBI documents relied upon by the Times were almost surely forgeries. Andrew Goldberg is the managing editor of The Smoking Gun and one of the investigators who debunked the Times story, and he joins us now. Hello, Andrew.
Hi. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. Okay. Now, help us understand how this came about. The LA Times comes up with this blockbuster scoop. It's by a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. It's backed up by FBI documents. What did you guys think of The Smoking Gun when you first saw this story?
Well, we knew they were working on this story because Chuck Phillips, the reporter who did the story for the LA Times, had a prior relationship, that he had had. We had had some dealings with him in the past. We had spoken to him. We were friendly. Okay. Not friends, but we were friendly. We knew the story was coming out. And then when it was posted on the web, on the LA Times website last Monday, we looked at it immediately. And one of the interesting things was they also included documents. And really, that's what we do. We do documents. So, of course, before we'll read a story, we'll look at the documents just because that's our area of interest. Looking at the documents, what it was two FBI 302 reports, which means that after the FBI interviews somebody, then they produce a 302, which is sort of a summary of that interview. So they're known in, language 302. That's the number on the top left-hand corner of them. There were two of them that they posted, and they didn't look right. Now, we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of 302s in folders in our office. We've put them up on our site, and there was something that just didn't feel right and look right, just from a quick cursory view of them.
How long did it take you to diagnose that, literally 5 seconds?
Yeah, I mean, it was basically just a matter of seconds, because although the framework for these documents, where the 302 was, where the lines were, where the date, where the page number was correct, the way that they looked, the body of the document did not look correct at all. And it's just a matter of anything you're used to seeing all the time. Now, most people are not used to seeing FBI 302s, so you don't really think much of it. So truthfully, if the LA Times had done the story and never posted the documents, we really wouldn't have had any basis to question what they were doing.
And there were clues in the actual typeface as well, correct?
Right. And there were a few things about the documents. One is the typeface didn't look right. There's a certain spacing that didn't appear right that you get used to seeing when you look at 302s. There was also double strikes. Maybe it's not the correct terminology if you're somebody who knows printing and such, but right. Where you type something and then you go, oh, I made a mistake there. I have to retype it. And you hit a letter over another letter that existed. That's impossible with today's computers to do that sort of thing.
I've actually done it. I'm so bad at typing that I figured out how to do it. But it's clear that there were some questionable aspects of these documents. What does that mean? What did that tell us in terms of this article?
Well, it told us that the documents, which we knew were the basis of this article. Now, Chuck Phillips has said at different times these weren't the most important part. They were just the icing on the cake for him. But to us, if the documents are wrong, then everything else gets called into question. You don't get to say, well, this part of the story is good, but just ignore that other part. So, and because we're document people, we looked and said, well, the documents aren't good. Now we've got to look at what we're dealing with here. Who is this Jimmy Sabatino?
So tell me more about him and the story that he constructed.
Well, the story he constructed for the LA Times was that he is basically the maypole around which many of the rap world's horrible events took place. The shooting of Tupac Shakur in November of 1994 here in New York at the Quad Studios. Jimmy Sabatino, who would have been at the time about 17 years old, 17-year-old, 5'5", white kid, happened to be at the Quad Studios. He was in a room when Tupac was shot downstairs. He let Puffy know, Sean Combs, that this was going to happen. Biggie knew it was going to happen. And he helped arrange it, the shooting that took place to get him there.
Right.
And he also happened to be on another floor. Now, the story is always that Tupac was shot, got into an elevator, went up to another floor, and came out, and he was bleeding. Now, according to these FBI documents that we looked at, Jimmy Sabatino sitting there, and I've just described what he looks like in this room. He's the only white kid in the room, and he says, get that piece of blank out of here.
Right.
In a room full of other people about Tupac Shakur.
Very probable, right?
Which we looked at, and we thought, somebody would have turned on the guy, right? Could
right.
you imagine? Now, he constructs other stories as well. My favorite, personally, my favorite Jimmy Sabatino story that he constructed was that at some point, things were going bad in the rap world, the East Coast and West Coast. There were a lot of problems. So there's Suge Knight on the West Coast. There's P. Diddy and Bad Boy on the East Coast. And Sean Combs reaches out to Jimmy Sabatino as an emissary for the East Coast to go to the West Coast and meet with Suge Knight and help settle these problems so that there can be some peace in the rap world.
Sure.
And
I'd pick a 5'5" pudgy white guy to do that.
And he goes to Vegas, and because Jimmy Sabatino tells the story, his father was a high-ranking member of the Colombo crime family, so he garnered a lot of respect in this world.
Right.
That's a total fabrication. As we say in his story, the only button his father ever got was given to him by his son. You know, he was a...
Right.
You know, he's not a mobster. He doesn't exist. Bill Bastone, who's the editor, who's my boss, covered the mafia for about 15-plus years at the Village Voice before we started doing this site. Never heard the name Peter Sabatino before, which is very odd because Bill is a very good mafia reporter.
And so it is this Jimmy Sabatino who has been giving this story to the LA Times and who produced these fake 305 documents.
Well, that's our interpretation of it. That's our story. Now, the LA Times, although they admitted that the story was based on bad documents, they haven't done their internal investigation, which is that they're going to most likely assign a couple of reporters to report the story out from the beginning. Where did we go wrong? Who were your sources? You know, step by step through it. We don't know at this point if they're going to come up with those same conclusions, but we were able to look, Jimmy Sabatino late last year started filing pro se lawsuits, which means he represented himself against Sean Puffy Combs. He was suing him for $175,000, said that he had had some audio and video tapes of Biggie Smalls, had cut a deal to give him to Puffy. Puffy took him, was supposed to give him $175,000, paid him $25,000, then paid him a little bit more, gave him a shout out on the radio once, but never came up with the rest of the money. Now, the reason why Puffy never came up with the rest of the money, according to Sabatino, is there was a rumor out in California making the way that Sabatino was somehow involved in the killing of the notorious B.I.G., Biggie Smalls. And he didn't want to be associated with this. I know you're laughing and it's sort of funny.
It's crazy, but...
But, you know, I can't make this stuff up.
Right.
But Sabatino is actually a sort of sad character, if you look at his history. But he makes up this story. And so he files this initial lawsuit looking for money from Puffy. Then a couple of months later, he files a second lawsuit in the same federal court in Florida. And this time he says that he wants Puffy to stop distributing these FBI reports, these 302s, and he details these four 302s that exist that he received from another case, a criminal case he had, that he had given to Puffy. Now, on the face of it, and Puffy then took them and started handing them out to an investigative journalist to smear him.
Right.
And it was costing business deals. But if you think about it, even if you ignore the fact that the guy's too young to be involved in this stuff, he's a white kid, you know, from Staten Island, lived in Staten Island, Brooklyn, and he spent almost his entire life locked up behind bars running scams like this. The fact that Puffy owes him money and now he's handing over documents to say, hey, look at these FBI reports that make us look bad. Let me give them to you. Isn't believable on its face.
And Jimmy probably was telling this entire story to the LA Times from his jail cell.
Well, they, you know, in their story, they claim that they didn't talk to him. Now, Jimmy Sabatino, we reached out to him. And he wrote us back and said he'll talk to us, but only off the record.
Right. Andrew, well, we need to take a break, so please hang on. In a minute, I want to hear about who you think is behind the rap wars of the 90s. Also, Ultimate Fighter Shad Smith. I'm Brian Donovan, in for Faye Saley. This is Fair Game from PRI. I'm Brian Donovan, in for Faye Saley, and this is Fair Game from PRI. I'm talking with Andrew Goldberg. He's managing editor for the website The Smoking Gun, which just completed an investigation that debunked an LA Times story alleging that the 1994 shooting of rapper Tupac Shakur was orchestrated by associates of rap impresario Sean Diddy Combs. So, Andrew, let's start with the facts. What do we know happened to Tupac on November 30th, 1994?
We know that he was at the Quad Studios in Midtown Manhattan. We know that he was there to record something. He walked in and there were three people. There was a shootout that took place, five bullets in Tupac. One of them may have been from his own gun, and people ripped off some jewelry from him. And then he stumbled into an elevator, ended up going into this room like we talked about earlier, sat down on a couch, and ended up in the hospital, which he spent a very short period of time. Now, at the same time this was going on, he was on trial in New York looking at jail time, prison time, on a sexual assault charge. So this is all happening in a very small window of time. And then the jury came back just days after this. So that's what happened at the Quad Studios. He was definitely shot there, and there were people there, and it's never been solved. Nobody's ever been able to say exactly who. But throughout his life, Tupac did point the finger at Sean Puffy Combs.
And probably, as far as we know, the closest James Sabatino to that was listening to a Tupac CD at the time.
He's an amazing guy because he did have the ability to, when he was not locked up, which was a very tiny little part of his life, to get close to very well-known people and to put himself in positions where he, you know, could benefit from that. There was a Miami New Times story which begins with James Sabatino sitting in a room with Julio Iglesias down in Miami. This is about the time that Tupac was shot. So he was able to weasel himself into these situations. And, you know, looking at his history, basically, you know, the guy back in started getting locked up, getting into trouble in 1994. Now, he was 17 years old at the time when he got arrested in Virginia running a credit card scam where he was using Coca-Cola company credit card at an airport and running up charges. So then he ends up in Florida. Now, in Florida, in early January of 95, the Super Bowl was down in Florida at that time. He was running a number of scams, but one of them was, and he was sort of brilliant. What he would do is he would write to the heads of companies. And he would get a letter back with a signature on their letterhead. Not so different than using the framework of an FBI 302. Then take that and create a letter from that, send it to a hotel, send it to a corporation, whatever he wanted to scam at the time, and then claim that he was this head of a company and then start getting stuff. So he was able to do that and get over 200 Super Bowl tickets for the Super Bowl at Joe Robbie Stadium.
I think I went with him.
Well, he didn't go, though. He sold the tickets. People discovered what was going on. He had them FedEx to him. Like, the tickets showed up, and he had all these Super Bowl tickets. He ends up locked up in Florida for a couple of years. He gets out in 97, and what does he do? He comes to New York. And he immediately throws himself a welcome home party here in New York, scams the hotel, the Marriott up here, and he gets arrested in New York.
Wow.
Decides he's going to leave the country, goes to the UK, and he runs a scam at the Four Seasons in the UK. Then he gets locked up there. But this is really one of my favorite crimes he did. He's locked up in the UK, and he's unhappy there, and he doesn't want to be there, so he decides, I'm going to get back to the US, and how am I going to do that? From the prison, he starts calling the White House, threatening to kill Bill Clinton. And if he can't get to him, he'll kill Roger Clinton. And he's threatening to kill U.S. attorneys, and he's threatening to blow up federal courthouses. But they still make him serve his time there. They bring him back here. They charge him with that. He assaults a federal corrections officer on his way back. He ends up locked up in a Westchester County jail. This is on the federal rap. And what he does there is he's running a credit card phone scam, where he makes over $1 million from Nextel getting cell phones sent to people. He's running this from inside the Westchester County Jail.
Wow.
And he's using people on the outside who he hardly even knows. He doesn't. Then that's what he's serving all this time on now. Now he's going to be looking at even more time.
Right. So he's like an unbelievably skilled businessman. He's
right.
Just using his powers for evil.
Evil, and he's incredibly self-destructive because every time he's close to getting out or freeing himself, he does something to add more to his time.
Do you think it seems like the sort of East Coast, West Coast rap wars are filled with bizarre moments like this and weird stories? Do you feel like the rap wars were real?
Well, I mean, they were very real because people died. You know, people were shot, and these are unsolved crimes. And I mean, there was a lot of silliness at the time. Now, I'm of the age where I was in college at the time. You know, I was buying the CDs and I was, you know, watching it on television. But I believed it was real at the time. Now, some of it, of course, was posturing. But Suge Knight is a bad guy. You know, I mean, he earned his reputation. And, you know, people got hurt throughout this whole thing. You know, just because the LA Times story, the documents weren't real, does not mean that Puffy wasn't somehow connected to what went on there. Tupac Shakur believed that all his life. You know, it's sort of like the old CBS defense that Dan Rather had. Well, the document, although he never said this, might not be real, but the story is true. We all know the story is true. So why are we focusing on the document?
But were these killings certainly happened, but do you feel that they were related to rap music and to the internal disagreements in the music industry?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of people settling disputes in very silly ways,
mm-hmm.
you know. And yeah, I mean, this incident, this event at the Quad, this shooting, is, as Chuck Phillips rightly says, the thing that sort of touched off that few years of East Coast, West Coast. And, you know, people were being shot at award shows, you know. I mean, there were people who couldn't show up at the same place. It's ridiculous, but it's also sort of a mysterious world to most people. So you can get away with a few crazy stories here and there.
I will say, Andrew, that you seem to know a suspicious amount about November 30th, 1994. Are you able to account for your whereabouts on that day?
Yeah, actually, I probably can come pretty close to accounting. I was in New York at the time.
Mm-hmm. Making calls.
And I was living in Midtown as well. So
a very shady area of Manhattan, I will say. Police officers who were waiting outside the studio. Andrew, thank you. This has been just a very interesting story to follow. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Andrew Goldberg is managing editor of the website The Smoking Gun. For more about him, please visit our website, morefairgame.org.